Hello, everybody. Dr. Lonnie Stewart here from the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. Are you a physical therapy student about to start studying for the National Physical Therapy Examination? Or maybe you're a professor, a program director, or a clinical instructor who teaches DPT students preparing for the NPTE? Either way, we would recommend checking out our sponsor, NPTE Final Frontier, and the community they've built around preparing for and succeeding on the NPTE. That exam and the preparation that goes along with it can be long, tedious, difficult, and stress-inducing, but it doesn't have to be. NPTE Final Frontier has the tactics and resources to help address all of the usual barriers. They even have scholarships to help with NPTE study courses, FSBPT registration fees, and even research opportunities. And if that's not enough, they're even donating to the very first annual HET Podcast Scholarship to be awarded at the end of every year. Go to npteff.com for all of the details and use code HET for 10% off all purchases. Links to both the NPTE Final Frontier and their scholarship options are available in the show notes. And now, let's get ready to learn.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Education Transformation Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. F. Scott Field. And I've got with me today special guest, Dr. Julie Evener, who's going to tell us a little bit about a cool process in starting and growing a peer review journal. So without any further ado, Dr. Evener, tell us a little bit about your academic journey and how it's led you to where you are today.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you, Dr. Field. So let me first talk a little bit about where I am today. So you have kind of that context. I'm the Director for Content Management and Discovery for USF Health Libraries. That's the University of South Florida Health Libraries. And essentially, I'm in charge of resources, collections. So I work a lot with scholarly publishing and publishers and all of those sorts of vendors who provide those products that make up an academic library and the resources available through an academic library. So that is my paying job. And I also am an associate editor for a new journal, Journal of Innovation in Health Science Education, JIHSE for short. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on a lot today. And that's, that's a volunteer position that I do that I, you know, it's just something I'm passionate about and something I'm involved in outside of my paying job. Given that, I'll say that I got into academic libraries as a result of my undergraduate education. I loved college. I loved it and really wanted to stay in the higher education arena for as long as possible. So I made the decision to get my master's degree in library and information science and became an academic librarian. And from there, my job kind of grew and I became a director at the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences. And kind of with that, I decided to get my doctorate degree in higher education leadership to help me with that journey. So I was with University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences for about 14 years and fairly recently made the move over to USF Health Libraries where I am now.
Well, I can honestly say that academic librarians are really the unsung heroes in publications and all things journals, because I would not have survived my dissertation were it not for you guys. So thank you, first off, for all that you've done for not only me, but for other healthcare professionals and everybody out there that's just, you know, struggling with the process of finding academic journals, how to publish, the process, the whole nine. It's not easy, which brings us here today to kind of talk about this. You have had the fortunate experience of starting a new journal, a peer-reviewed journal. So tell us a little bit about why. What is your why behind starting this journal? Let's start there.
Yeah. So for us, I'll say I'm on an editorial board. I'm an associate editor on an editorial board with three other editors. Our editor-in-chief is Dr. Elizabeth McGee. We also have Dr. Genevieve Zipp from Seton Hall and Dr. Maria Puzaferro. So those are our four editorial board members, founding editorial board members. And for us, it was really to promote innovation in health sciences education. Coming out of three of the four of us, and now two of the four of us are with the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences. And they really do some great things at the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences with innovation and incorporating that into the student experience and training really the healthcare practitioner of the future, of the present and future, right, going forward. And so we really wanted to promote that idea of innovation, of incorporating not just technologies, right, but other innovative ways of teaching and of learning and bringing that in and showcasing what other institutions are doing, what instructors are doing, faculty members are doing to make health sciences education more innovative for our students. It also tied in really nicely with the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences, the goal of that institution of being kind of a premier health sciences institution and an innovative institution. So it tied in really well. Another piece that, at least to me, was really important and a driving factor is this idea of open access publishing. The Journal of Innovation in Health Sciences Education is an open access journal. What that means is that when we publish issues, they are immediately available freely to anybody who wants to access them. There's no subscription fees, anything like that. That's something that I'm very passionate about. This is maybe a topic that's not as publicized or not talked about as much, at least maybe outside of library circles. You know, scholarly publishers have huge profit margin, almost unbelievably huge profit margins. One of the larger scholarly publishers, Elsevier, their profit margins are regularly like 40%. You know, we think of some of these tech giants like Google and Facebook and things like that. Their profit margins of Google and Facebook are more like 20%, right? So Elsevier's are like 40%. And that makes sense when you think about it, because the content, at least as far as scholarly journals, and a lot of the labor are free, essentially. Researchers who publish they're not getting paid for publishing. They're at least not directly from the journal, right? They might be paid because they're a faculty member and part of their responsibility is research, but they're not being paid for that content. The peer reviewers aren't being paid. Often the editors aren't being paid. It's all in the name of service to the profession, right? And service to academia. You kind of add to that this idea that a lot of that research to begin with is sort of publicly funded, either through federal grants or institutional grants, that sort of a thing. You get this kind of strange scenario where academic institutions, especially public academic institutions, are essentially paying for research twice. They're paying for researchers to do the research through grants, through, you know, hiring the researchers, and then through their academic libraries, they're paying for access to that research, subscribing to these journals. Academic libraries spend a ton of money. That's the majority of an academic library's budget is spent on scholarly journals. And so they're paying for it twice. And so this idea of open access is not only about making that research more accessible, right? We know that when research is more accessible, it's better for everybody because more people have access to it. They can read it, they can build on it, and it just progresses the research farther. And so to me, open access publishing is something I'm passionate about. It's something I'm committed to. And there's an additional piece. I mean, there are overhead costs to publishing, right? And so a lot of the not-for-profit open access publishers charge APCs, article processing charges, to the researchers who are wanting to publish. And that's just to cover those overhead costs, the infrastructure, the platform fees, things like that. And so a nice thing with a case like this, where we are publishing a journal through an academic library's digital publishing program, is that a lot of those overhead costs are kind of things that are already in the library's budget that they would be paying for anyway. As an example, our journal is published through a platform called Digital Commons and through the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences Library. And they would be paying for that whether they were using all of the pieces of it or not. They're using it for dissertation publishing, for their students, you know, things like that. And there's no additional cost to publish journals through the same platform. So we don't need to charge article processing charges in our case, because the overhead costs are kind of already covered, which is a really nice situation to be in, that it's really a gold open access situation.
Yeah. And I think, you know, one of the major barriers in healthcare these days is that separation from like the ivory tower of academia to clinical work, and the time it takes to get from research to implementing in the clinic is ridiculous. It's something like 5 to 10 years. And part of that is access to the research. I mean, we're doing the research. We're just not easily able to get it out and about to the people that need it, the clinicians, the ones that are going to be implementing. So it's definitely, you know, financially, that's a huge barrier. So, you know, definitely. Open access is awesome. Like, that's definitely a way that we need to start trending. Cause like you said, the profit margins are insane. So like,
definitely,
what are we, you know, what are we doing?
Yeah. And I mean, and for a clinician who has access, you know, to an academic library, they have easier access to some of those things. A lot of big hospitals have, you know, pay for subscriptions and things, have hospital libraries. But you think of, you know, the majority are likely clinicians who are working at smaller clinics, right? And what access do they have? You know, their employers are likely not able to purchase big group subscriptions or provide money to access these sorts of articles. And, you know, if you're buying an article, a typical cost is like $30 for access to the article for a period of 24 hours. It's not even $30 and you get a PDF in a lot of cases, right? You can pay us $30 and then you can read this article on our platform for a period of 24 hours and then you lose access again. It's definitely a problem.
Yeah, it's nuts. So let's talk a little bit about then the process of starting this journal, because that, again, not an easy task, not an easy feat. Tell us a little bit about the process of starting a peer-reviewed journal.
Yeah, so it depends who you're publishing with, but I can talk about, in our case, how it kind of went. We're publishing through the University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences Libraries. And prior to our journal kind of getting off the ground, they were already publishing two journals. One is a student journal of occupational therapy, and the other is the official journal of the Philippine Physical Therapy Association. So that's kind of a cool partnership. And so we were kind of the third journal to be launched through this publishing program. You know, it really started with this idea of colleagues kind of getting together and saying, this is something we'd love to do. This is something we're interested in doing. And from there, the topic, finding the niche, is really important, right? As far as starting a journal, you don't want to be white noise in an oversaturated sort of a market. Like, what is the niche thing here that this journal is going to bring to the table that isn't already out there or isn't out there in an accessible way, maybe? There's a lot of Google searching, right, involved in seeing what journals are out there in this area that we're thinking of. What are they called? What are their aims and scope? Something different, something unique that we can bring to the table if we're doing this. So that's a big thing. Again, open access comes into play here, right? You have to decide all of these things about a journal that you're starting and coming in. For how we were publishing, the open access was a given. That's kind of the only kind of journal that this publishing does, this publishing institution does, University of St. Augustine for Health Sciences Libraries. That's kind of the agreement. When you kind of agree to publish a journal through them, you're signing as editors this agreement that this is going to be an open access journal. So that was kind of a given for us. But, you know, in other cases, that might need to be a decision. What kind of a model is this journal going to have? I mentioned aims and scopes. That's a huge thing. Aims and scope. Obviously, getting your editorial board together is a big thing, and finding somebody, people who are interested. You know, we've got a small editorial board to start with, plans to grow that as the journal grows. But we've got our four kind of founding editors that we have. It was important to us to have editorial board members that weren't all University of St. Augustine people, even though that was where this journal was coming from. This isn't a journal that is a University of St. Augustine journal, right? Like some sort of vanity press or something like that. This is a serious, you know, legitimate journal. And so we wanted to, you know, give every indication. You know, another part of some of my work is helping researchers determine what's a good fit journal for them to publish their work in. And part of that is these red flags for predatory journals, right? And so when you're starting a journal, you have to look at what are the red flags for predatory journals so that you can not send those flags, right? You can make sure that you're showing that you are not of that genre of journals, and that you are a legitimate, you know, ethical publisher, ethical journal. We definitely wanted a varied editorial board. When we started, it was three of the four of us. Now it's two of the four of us are outside of University of St. Augustine versus inside. And we do have a stipulation in our journals kind of ground rules or whatever the term is, policies, that at least one editorial board member does need to be affiliated with the University of St. Augustine. But other than that, you know, we want a broad kind of a group, right, to be on our editorial board. Policies, right? We have to come up with policies, manuscript guidelines, all of these things that journals have. You have to create, right, and determine, make decisions about how you want your journal to fit into all of that. The nice thing is that we're not doing it from scratch. We didn't do it from scratch, right? We could look at all these other journals that are out there and kind of see how they're doing it and make decisions based on that. We had a fantastic assistant, so to speak, in Eric Robinson. who was one of the librarians at the University of St. Augustine, kind of over the digital publishing program, very instrumental in creating that digital publishing program at the University of St. Augustine, who is just an expert in these things, very knowledgeable, and was able to guide us through this process. Just invaluable, the assistance that he gave us. So looking at templates, examples from other journals, pulling that in, but it's a lot of decisions. It's a lot of making choices, deliberate, you know, choices about what we want our journal, how we want our journal to function, and what we want our journal to do. So once we kind of got all that figured out, there was design involved with designing the site and that sort of a thing. The stage we're in now is we have not published our first issue yet, but we are accepting manuscripts for our first issue. Once we have kind of a good group of you know, maybe two or three, you know, manuscripts that have gone through our peer review process and are ready for publication, that'll be kind of our first issue at that point. So that's kind of where we are now. We've launched in that we are accepting manuscripts. We're, you know, recruiting peer reviewers. We've got a good group of peer reviewers and are continuing to recruit peer reviewers. And we've got several manuscripts that have been submitted to us at this point that are at varying stages of the process of getting ready for publication. So it's been a long journey, I'll say. It's probably been about like 2 years since we first started the process to now. So it's definitely not, it's not a short process. It's not an easy process. There's a lot to it, especially when you're, you know, doing your full-time job on top of doing all of this. But it's also been really fun. It's been really exciting. And it's been a really learning experience for sure.
And now for a quick shout out to our newest sponsor, Varela Financial. If you're a physical therapist and you have student loan debt, you got to talk to these guys. What makes them unique is that they view financial planning like running hurdles on a track. And for PTs, the first hurdle many of us run into is student loan debt. Varela Financial will help you get over that hurdle. They not only take the time to explain to you which plans you individually qualify for and how those plans work, but they also take the time to show you what your individual case looks like, mapped out within each option. So if you're looking for help on your student loan debt or any area of personal finances, we recommend working with them. I use Varela Financial personally, and they were able to help me lower my student loan repayment from about $1,800 a month down to about $135 per month simply by finding the right repayment plan that best fit me, my family, and our life goals. You can check them out at VarelaFinancial.com. Link is in the show notes if you need it for reference, and tell them the HET podcast crew sent you. And now back to the show.
Awesome.
What's one tip or trick or pointer you would give to somebody who's thinking about starting a journal?
Patience. Everything's going to take longer than you think it will take by virtue of just all of the moving parts that need to come together, schedules of the people that all need to make decisions together. So patience for sure, being realistic about the time commitment and honest with yourself about whether this is something you can take on. Definitely being part of founding a new journal is a lot more of a time commitment than being an editor on an already established journal, right? I mean, the first, you know, 2 years already without, we've been working on it, right? But we didn't have a website for a lot of the times we were working on it. So who knew we were working on it, right? But it was still taking up a lot of our time. And, you know, once we get going, it'll be like a normal level of editorship, you know, the time commitment. But up until we get really going, there's a lot of extra stuff that you have to make decisions, publicize. There's a lot of, you know, publicizing that needs to happen so that people know that you exist and they will submit things. It's a time commitment. There's a lot of legwork to get a journal started. And it is more of a time commitment than signing on to be an editor at an already established journal.
Yeah. All right. Selfishly, because I'm new to the publishing game, what advice do you have, or what do people need to consider? Any recommendations that you have if they're looking to submit an article for publication? What does that look like?
For sure, if there's a particular journal that you're thinking of submitting to, you want to pay very close attention to that journal's website, their aims and scope, their manuscript or author guidelines, policies, things like that. You want to make sure it's a mutual fit. It's a waste of everyone's time, really, if you're submitting an article type or an article topic or, you know, something like that, that journal doesn't even publish, right? And so it just kind of wastes everybody's time, gets your hopes up for nothing, that sort of a thing. It's important to make sure that it's a mutual fit, that your manuscript is a good fit for that journal is a good fit for you, depending on what you're looking for in publishing. You know, oftentimes if you are maybe publishing your first article, it's a little easier maybe to say, take a chance on a new journal, you know, or something like that versus something that's got a really high impact factor or something that's been really established. There's trade-offs for sure, right? Those journals with high impact factors, yeah, it's a wow factor when you're published by them, but they get way more submissions than they can ever publish, right? And so starting out maybe with a newer journal or a journal that is a little bit more niche, if you fit that niche of what they're doing, you have a better chance of getting published and kind of starting there and going on. So that's the biggest thing. Make sure you're reading all of the information. It's a fit for your manuscript. The journal is a fit for what your goal is in publishing and going from there. And for sure, as I mentioned, avoid those predatory journals. There's some red flags.
Let's talk about that a little, because again, I've seen them. I know it's not good. What, both from a journal perspective and from somebody who's submitting to journals, what are some of those red flags to look out for with predatory journals?
Yeah, so it's definitely a red flag if you get an email directly to you inviting you to, hey, submit to this journal. And I've gotten these where, you know, the journal, it's either something very large and vague, like Journal of the Humanities, or, you know, something that just seems like, wow, there's a lot that could be published in that journal, or something that's not really even a fit for what your research areas are or what your specialties are. And they're directly soliciting you saying, oh, hey, we'd love for you to submit your, that's a red flag, right? It sounds like it's one of those too good to be true scenarios. I'll say that there are legitimate journals who might reach out to like an expert researcher in a field and ask them to submit something. But if you know you're not really at that point, you know, then you should be suspicious if a journal is reaching out to you. Another red flag would be if they say that they have fees, but they don't really spell out what those fees are. I talked earlier about article processing charges. These can be legitimate, right? There are journals that have legitimate article processing charges. And so it's not necessarily an article processing in and of itself that's a red flag. But if it's not clear, right? Or they say, if all of a sudden they're asking for money and they'd never mentioned that before, that would be a red flag as well. You want to look up the journal. What have they already published? Do they have things published? If it's a new journal, you know, that's a little bit different. There's some leeway there. But also looking up, if it is a new journal that doesn't have a lot published, who's on their editorial board? A lot of times these predatory journals will just pull names from like higher education institution websites and say that these people are on their editorial board, and these people have never even heard of this so-called journal, right? And so things like, do they have a physical address? And is it a real physical address? You can plug it into Google Maps. Is this a real physical address? Is it affiliated with a publisher you've heard of or an institution that you've heard of, a legitimate institution? You know, these sorts of things. There's a little bit of legwork for sure that you need to make sure that this is a legitimate journal and a good journal, right? Like if they have issues published, take a look at what they've already published. You know, are these quality sorts of articles? Is this quality research?
And that can help you with submitting as well. You want your paper to mirror or reflect those types of articles that have already been published.
Definitely.
So that it fits their you know, vibe and what they're all about. So I get that. That's awesome. Thank you for sharing that this way.
Yeah.
Hopefully people can be aware of what to look out for and not get scammed by these predatory journals.
Yes.
Well, Dr. Evener, I can't thank you enough for taking the time and for coming on to share all your knowledge and your experience with starting a new journal. We like to ask all of our guests this final question, and that question is, if you could change one aspect of higher education, what aspect would you change and how would you change it?
Yeah, that's a big question. that's a big question. One thing, I've been talking, you know, about kind of one topic this whole time, and there are things to change there, which I've already mentioned with open access and some of the, you know, those sorts of things. But it's tangential to higher education, but it's not necessarily as much in higher education. So I'd like to talk a little bit about a different issue that's not really related to what we've talked about so far, but higher education is really, I think, in flux, especially since COVID, with enrollments being down. I mean, really over the last decade, enrollments have been decreasing, and certainly the pandemic did not help that situation. There's also this increasing pressure to justify the value of higher education, of a higher education degree. And, you know, with that, I think there's a lot of focus on admissions, which is valid. But I think kind of the The flip side to that is persistence to graduation, right? You can enroll, you know, admit as many people as you want, but if they're not persisting to graduation, that creates a whole host of problems, not only for the institution, but I think for society as large. That's where you get these students who have these massive student loan debts, but didn't earn the degree, and so don't have that income power to be able to repay them, right? And so I think that's it's a huge issue. With that, I think is this idea of access, diversity, and inclusion in higher education, and really what that's about. So a few years ago, I want to say it was 2018, but I went to this talk at a conference from a gentleman from, I think it was Georgia State University, and he was talking about just the way that they kind of approached this issue at Georgia State University. They have a lot of Pell Grant students at their institution, that sort of a thing. And, you know, he kind of said, well, you know, it was just kind of assumed that students in certain demographics, Pell Grant students, things like that, would graduate at lower rates than other groups of students. It was just kind of an assumption. And so they kind of stopped and they said, why? And they kind of rejected this assumption that it's the students. And they said, is it us? Is it us? What are we doing to make this harder for these students? And they used data to find pain points, and they identified all of these kind of simple but really impactful things that they could do. Things like, okay, we've admitted a student, they're excited to start, they can pay for it. Oh, the state of Georgia requires us to ask for their immunization, you know, records. That's a pain point for a lot of students. They don't have those records. They're somewhere, maybe their parent, an absent parent potentially has that somewhere, but they don't have access to it. So they started having immunization buses come and give free immunizations to students, you know, at some of these, or potential students at some of their events, right? And so they can have those records and be able to enroll, right? So there's clerical things really that are stopping students a lot of times. Another example is they started doing these mini grants, kind of automatic mini grants to students who, you know, maybe a semester or two away from graduating, and they're having to stop out because they owe this $500. They've got most of their tuition covered, but they've got this $500 that they can't pay. And so they're going to stop out. And there's all this data that if a student stops out, they're not necessarily coming back, right? And so they started automatically, you know, for students who were at a certain progression point and underneath a certain dollar amount, they just automatically applied grants to those students' accounts. The students didn't have to apply for them. They just applied them, and those students were able to continue, which is a win-win, right, for the students. It's a win for the university because if those students who are short $500 have to pull out completely, that's thousands of dollars that the institution loses. And it's good for society as a whole. So they made these small changes that were really impactful. And they, in 2018, they reported that since that kind of for the previous 4 years, so 2014 to 2018, African-American, Hispanic, first-generation, and Pell-eligible students at their institution, on average, graduated at or above the rates of the student body overall. And that was kind of unheard of at that point. So the changes that they made really worked. So that's, I think, a problem. And I think following that model that Georgia State University did to make these small, impactful changes is a solution to fixing that and helping students to persist and making higher education more accessible to a wider variety of students as well.
Yeah. Accessibility has always been a huge issue. And it feels like just now within the last couple of years, are we starting to try to address it, which obviously now we're behind the eight ball. So we got to catch back up, but definitely at least it's, you know, made aware of, and we're trying to do things now to address it. So that's a great answer. I appreciate that.
Thanks.
Well, where can people reach out to you and find you if they just have follow-up questions or want to know more about the journal or, you know, want to see what you're up to these days? Where can people find you?
Definitely. Yeah. So especially for the journal, soar.usa.edu/JIHSE is our website. And so that's got all of the information. There's a link there to say that you want to be a reviewer. You can look at submitting a manuscript if that's something you're interested in there. You can contact the editorial board there. If somebody wants to just contact me directly, my email address is jevener1@usf.edu. That's jevener1@usf.edu. So feel free to reach out to me directly as well, and I'd be happy to continue the conversation.
Awesome. We'll drop those links in the show notes so everybody can find you very easily. Dr. Evener, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure chatting with you today.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Well, I hope that episode was entertaining as much as it was informational and educational. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our past episodes, we ask you to please subscribe to the podcast and leave us a rating and review. And please share out the episodes to those who you feel may be able to benefit from them. We also urge you to follow us on all social media platforms at HET Podcast and let us know what topics or experts you would like to hear from in future episodes. And just as a reminder, none of the information on today's show should be considered medical advice. It's simply infotainment or edutainment to help educate our audience. For medical advice, we always advise you to reach out to your preferred medical professionals, and we'll see you on the next show.